We should be so proud that we have, that we are the richest newt asset in Europe. I mean, I'm as proud of our newts as the Spanish should be of their lynx.
Bespectacled little chum.
Oh, all right, thank you, my floppy-haired, tired-looking little princess. Welcome, listener, to Sustainababble, your weekly environment podcast, weekly-ish, about people and the planet, and why, despite everything being alarming and scary, we can still have a little bit of a chuckle every now and then. I hear we've got something rather exciting happening this week.
We've got something very exciting happening this week. You may have noticed, listener, that there's been a Brexit. And that Brexit got all the more Brexity in recent days with the triggering of Article 50. So we decided we'd better find out what that meant for the environment.
What do you trigger an Article 50? What's got to be triggered for?
I don't know. It's just the words that people use these days, isn't it? Apparently it's triggered. This Article 50 of them triggered. Anyway, the point is, it's happened. Brexit is becoming more of a reality, and that has implications for the environment, probably quite profound ones. But we don't really know what they are, so we decided to speak to somebody who does. And that person is, I'm delighted to say, Stanley Johnson. Stanley is a very long-standing environmentalist, former MEP, all sorts of things, and also the father of somebody relatively famous that you might have heard of in politics.
Yes, indeed. So we talked to Stanley over Skype a little while ago, and so this is what we said. But before you hear that, this is just the usual disclaimer. We do work for environmental charities, but these are very much either our own views or Stanley's own views. So don't take any of it up with us or anyone that we work for, or you will trigger our bosses to kick us in the bottom. And that's not what we want, is it?
Not at all. Right, let's listen to Stanley. So we are joined now by Stanley Johnson. Hello, Stanley.
Well, hello, Dave. Hello, Ollie.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you very, very much for joining us. Stanley, as many of our listeners will know, is a former MEP, and a prominent environmentalist and author, and was the co-chair of the organisation Environmentalists for Europe. So knows a thing or two about the green movement and Europe, and that is what we're here to talk about today.
And must be, I assume, fairly downbeat about everything at the moment, therefore. Is that right?
It is tricky. I mean, as you rightly said in your introduction, Ollie, I have been doing this for some time. In fact, I've been doing it, if I think about it, even before I joined the EU, which was on the 1st of January 1973, because I'd been in the World Bank before that. And, you know, I'd been very much on the environmental side in the World Bank, actually particularly on the population side, because for me, the key issue, still for me remains the key issue, is the whole demographic and population issue. That to me was the root of most of the environmental problems we had. Anyway, yes, it has been a tricky time on two fronts then. It's been tricky on the environmental front because I think there's a real risk that a lot of the good things we put into place over 40 years of EU environmental policy may go down the drain. And then, of course, for me, I was a believer in Europe. You can't have been there for 40 years. You can't be one of the first Brits to go to Brussels, as I said I was in 1973 as we first joined, without, slightly believing in the European project. It's very interesting to me indeed to see how the Conservative Party, which was the party which took us in 1970, well, I think we signed up in 1971 to join in 1973, but that was under Edward Heath's Conservative Party took us in. When I first went in as an MEP, because I started off with the Commission, then the MEP in 1979, there were 61 pretty pro-European conservative MEPs. And it is remarkable now, if you made a quick calculation as to who the remaining self-avowed Europhiles in the British Conservative Party now, you know, you could probably count them on the fingers of two hands. I mean, they are now in the minority, whereas before they were very much in the majority.
So that brings us on very nicely to the current Conservative leadership. What do you feel about Theresa May's commitment to the environment? Because, I mean, she has gone on record in the past when the Climate Change Act was being put forward as being a strong supporter of action on climate change. But do you think that now the reality of dealing with Brexit means that the environment is just not going to feature in her programme or what?
This is a very interesting question. Don't let's forget that Theresa May was the Shadow Secretary of State for the Environment. I suppose, you know, as any people like you and me who have these facts firmly in our minds, quite a lot of people out there might have forgotten the key fact that she was the Shadow Secretary of State for the Environment, but she was. I have no reason to suppose that she is not interested in the environment. Absolutely none at all. But I think you put your finger on it when you said Brexit is going to be all-absorbing. Now, I would make one little caveat, because a couple of days ago, as you probably know, the government did put out its white paper, its Brexit white paper. And I looked to see environment among the key list of topics. And I've got to tell you, it was not really there. Yes, the word environment appeared from time to time in the document. I have read the whole document. I'm talking now about the white paper. But it mainly occurred in the context of, let's get a better environment for business, if you see what I mean.
Yes, the climate for business. That's right, yeah.
And climate for business. That's the advantage of having this, you know, search and find thing on your computer. You can tap in the word environment. You don't always get what you expected. However, help is at hand. Because I did also, in the context of this quick search, read the Welsh government's white paper on the environment. And I just want to tell you and tell your listeners, your loyal listeners, if they're still with us, I just want to tell you that go to the Welsh government's website and look up the Welsh government's white paper on the environment. And there you will see not only does environmental policy feature among the main chapter headings of its concern, but there's a perfectly good whole chapter itself, which does actually spell out perfectly clearly why we do need to make sure we don't lose all the good things which were developed over 40 years as a result of, or at the same time as, if you like, our membership in the European Union.
So what are the main things from an environmental point of view? I mean, there's a lot of stuff about Brexit that worries me, but from an environment point of view, can you sort of explain to people who don't know what the main things are?
The importance now, I think, is to be sure that as we bring over environmental legislation into the Great Repeal Bill, you know, that is clear that there is a commitment to do that. That commitment has not been lost. But we do need to be clear that when the EU legislation comes in, it doesn't get hacked around and emasculated or otherwise denatured as it were, is repatriated. I think that is a really, really important thing. And I've got to say, I sense danger signals. There's some danger signals out there already. I was very heavily involved in drafting a lot of EU environmental legislation because I started off, as I mentioned, in 1973 when we were developing the first environmental action program, went on to the European Parliament, 1979 to 84, came back to the European Commission as environmental advisor in 84 up till 1990. I was very heavily involved in a lot of it. And take, for example, the Habitats Directive, the Nature Protection Directives, the Birds Directives, the Habitats Directive. Now, I do notice that the the leading Brexiteers, and I suppose I'm talking about people like George Eustace and Patterson.
And your son, to be perfectly honest.
Well, no, but I'm not talking about, I don't think he, to my knowledge, has laid into the Habitats record yet, but some of the other leading Brexiteers have decided that they want to make the Habitats Directive, which in this country has, you know, become almost a kind of symbol of Europe, of our efforts at nature protection. They want to, I think they want to make it into a kind of sacrificial lamb. I notice, for example, the Daily Telegraph is now running a campaign of, you know, let's tear up the regulations. Mm. And one of the things they are picking on, apart from bendy bananas and stuff like that, is the nature protection directives. And then you have a fellow like Michael Gove. Michael Gove writes an article in The Independent just the other day saying, we've got to get rid of the Habitats Directive because it stops somebody building a house here or there. And of course, they love going for the nukes. We should be so proud that we are the richest newt asset in Europe. I mean, I'm as proud of our newts as the Spanish should be of their lynx.
Have we only got newts because of you? Is the salvation of the great crested newt, is that on your shoulders? Did you do that?
No, I think it would have. I think that is probably also protected under various various UK. I mean, they're probably sites of special scientific interest. But what is absolutely clear is that sites which are protected under the EU Habitats Directive and under the Birds Directive have a much higher legal level of protection than those which are protected under UK law. So that's my real worry here, that in the actual scope of the directives may be slashed, and B, that the level of protection which is produced by the EU may be watered down. And of course, it is important that we recognize that. And there's a useful body which some of your listeners may well be associated with, which is called the UK Environmental Law Association. And they've produced just yesterday a statement. It is worth mentioning, saying what their priorities.
So at this point, Stanley walked us through in quite a lot of detail some of the technicalities of Article 50 and some really interesting quotes from the UK Environmental Law Association, which was fantastic, but probably a little bit beyond the scope of this particular podcast. And so we're going to bring him back now when he's talking about some of the meatier stuff around Brexit and the wider context.
Tofu, yes, stuff.
Some of the tofu-y stuff around Brexit.
Ensuring its continued enforcement. But we have to look ahead, and you know, there are many, many things which still need to be done, and some of those might well have been done at EU level. My particular bugbear at the moment is plastic bottles. Mm. I would very much like to see us move ahead very rapidly on plastic bottles. Of course, the EU would have been a fabulous dimension to have done this. We could have had EU-wide standards on returnable plastic bottles or whatever, and I don't want to find that kind of thinking disappears totally when we don't have the European dimension. We need to be able now. Andrea Leadsom is committed, as you know, to produce this 25-year environmental plan.
Now, Stanley just mentioned Andrea Leadsom. Who is Andrea Leadsom and why is she relevant in this context?
I'm reasonably sure she is a one- or two-time inhabitant of Inhofe Corner, for a start, but she is the Environment Secretary, she is somebody who, before becoming Environment Secretary, knew about as much about the environment as this ironing board does here, i.e. not very much, thinks that the best way to protect the environment is to shoot badgers in the face and to let companies do whatever they want and kiss farmers in sensitive areas or something.
I've got history with Andrea Leadsom. We clashed over the whole let's delete support for solar issue, in which she said that we were scaremongering because I said that people were going to lose their job. And 12,000 job losses later, I think I was right, which is good news for me, terrible news for the 12,000 people who lost their jobs.
Oh, look, shut up. We're not interested in you. We're talking to Stanley. Come back, Stanley.
Sorry, right.
I worry that the NGOs may say, oh, well, now it's fine. We've got a 25-year environmental plan. Mm. You know, we can forget about, you know, applying this or applying that. I mean, a plan, you know, we don't butter parsnips with a plan. You butter parsnips with legally enforceable rules. Take Air pollution. I mean, air pollution is about the most current environmental issue we have in this country at the moment. The figure for unnecessary deaths in London is 4,000 a year out of a total of, I think, it's something like 25,000. I might be wrong about that.
It's higher, actually, yeah. It's the Royal College of Physicians say 40,000, yeah.
40,000, right. Well, frankly, you know, you could always say that one death is one death too many. But why? Why have we even begun to get a hold on this problem? It's because a good organization like Client Earth went to the High Court, got a ruling that the government's plans on air pollution did not conform to the obligation they had taken on under the European Commission's, European Community's air quality standards, particularly for NOx, and the government was forced to come back with a new plan. Well, all that'll go, all that kind of extra-national or supranational, maybe it's better to say extra-national, supranational really seems to make people cross. Let's say we invent a new word called extra-national. That kind of extra-national pressure, it won't be there, and we need to be sure that we keep it up.
So you set up one of the founders of Environmentalists for Europe, which I guess is kind of twiddling its thumbs now, wondering what to do, and you know, ever fewer people sitting around having cake and that kind of thing. But you said it was going to be a tragedy if Britain left the EU. Do you still think that? I mean, do you still feel do you feel like something tragic has happened, or you're a bit more reconciled to it now, perhaps?
This is very interesting. Can one be reconciled to a tragedy? Well, did I say that? I haven't said that in the course of this interview, but you probably mean I said it.
Previously.
Lots of people have said things in the past. Nowadays, what we do tend to say is we are where we are. That's what we say. We are where we are. Yes, of course, I'm sorry about it, because I actually do think that we could have avoided that particular outcome. I have a feeling that, you know, maybe if more progress had been made on the immigration issue, and maybe if Mr. Cameron had pushed a little bit harder on his immigration solution, and maybe if the Germans had been a little bit more flexible on that one, we might not be where we are. Okay, looking ahead, because as you rightly say, I have a son who played a leading role in this, and not only played a leading role in the run-up to the referendum, but probably will continue to play a leading role, not necessarily as part of the Brexit negotiation, but at least as foreign secretary. And he has an optimistic outlook on this. I'm perfectly ready to share an optimistic outlook, but in doing so, it would be on the assumption that the kind of points I mentioned a moment ago are met. I mean, and that includes maintaining the environmental acquis, maintaining the framework for enforcing it, maintaining the possibility of developing it and going further, and of course, maintaining all the international contacts, which we develop not just at a European level, but also by being part of the EU, we developed hugely important as were environmental links with the US, with China, and even with the developing world. Yeah, I'm perfectly happy to be optimistic. I look out of my window, and what do I see? I see a sunny garden. I see a little train running through at the bottom of my garden, a little overground train. I'm sure it's very environmentally conscious.
I thought you meant you had like a model railway in your garden.
Yeah, no. it's a nice little overground which runs from Kew Gardens, you know, to Acne. I'm sorry, not Acne, Hackney.
So, if you don't mind us saying, you've been at this a while. You've
probably been going for 15, 20 minutes now.
Longer term than that. I meant you've been at this for 50 odd years, if not more. You've been all over the world. You've written about Antarctica, president of the Gorilla Society. How do you think it's all going to go? I mean, how do you think it's going to pan out? If you look back at the sort of the journey that you've been on, the things you've learned, and where you think things are now, do you remain optimistic or what? And I'm thinking, you know, for our listeners who maybe got a long time still ahead to live in the world that we're building, kind of what do you think? What's your message for them? Are you optimistic about it all?
Well, I go back really to great people. When I started in this business, I said I went to the World Bank. I didn't say, but I did go to the World Bank in 1966 before I went to the EU in 73. And, you know, for me, in the run-up to the beginning of the 1970s was the great peak of the environmental movement in many ways. And you had extraordinary people like Barbara Ward on the one hand, who wrote Only One Earth for the first conference on the human environment, which was in 1972 in Stockholm. I went there. You had Paul Ehrlich, for example, who wrote Population Resources and Environment. You had, obviously, E.F. Schumacher. So the great intellectual challenge at that time was to recognize that, essentially, it is impossible to protect the environment given continued population growth on the one hand and economic growth on the other hand. So I'm still, you know, a kind of dyed-in-the-wool a conservationist to that extent. And I say, in the long run, we have to look forward not to a population constantly expanding with economic growth constantly expanding, which is the only thing you ever hear politicians talk about. Mm. We have to say to ourselves, look, wouldn't it be so much better to have a much smaller population in Britain? You could actually, if we had a much smaller population, probably have a much larger per capita income growth. I mean, one of the reasons, you know, we have this constantly expanding economy is we feel that, you know, we still need to give people more and more resources. But if you had fewer people might be content with a smaller economy. I think this is a seed which falls on stony ground in the current political climate. Although I have noticed that there are some political people out there. I mean, Caroline Lucas would be one, for example, who are ready to speak about the need for the stable economy and the stable population. I'd go further and I'd like to see a declining economy and a declining population. But that's, so you're saying, what would my vision be for the world in, well, I'm afraid we know what the world in 2050 is going to be. It's going to be about 9.5 billion people. But my vision for the world in, let's say, 2150 would hopefully to be fewer people than that. And that will require a huge demographic transition to happen, particularly in Africa. Because in Africa, we are at the moment not at all in the demographic transition phase, at least as far as the northern swathe of that continent is concerned. I mean, you know, Nigeria is going to be quite soon 800 million people, for example. So I think that looking ahead, I think we have to deal with that. The developments in the United States do not make life easier, I've got to say. I mean, it does not.
Yes. That's our analysis as well.
And today there's a good article in the New York Times, which you may not have seen, saying China hopefully will take the lead on climate change. Well, fine, and that is wonderful. But you say to yourself, how long will countries take the lead on climate change, like China, even like Britain, who has taken the lead with its Climate Change Act of 2008? How long will they go on with that when they see other major economies, you know, backing off? And I'm not 100% convinced, for example, that Russia, not that Russia is one of the top economies in the world. I think the Russian output is about the size of the state of California,
smaller than Italy.
Yes, exactly. And although they get a, you know, big bang for their buck, don't they, in terms of world influence, I've got to say. Mm. Imagine if Italy had the kind of world influence that President Putin did. I mean, just imagine, we could have pasta coming out of our ears. And the mama used to say all the time, what's the matter you? Hey, God, no respect. What do you think you do? Why you look so sad? Anyway, well, look, you two. I can't tell you what a joy it has been to talk to you today. It's a wonderful sunny day out there. We ought to get out and enjoy it.
Absolutely. I 100% agree with that. Thank you so much, Stanley, for sharing your time and a little bit of your extraordinary career. Is there any way that people can follow what you're doing now? Is there anything you want to plug that you have projects that are in the pipeline?
On September the 28th, my new book will be published by One World Publications. Now, One World Publications is a very reputable publishing house. It's had the last two Booker Prizes. Not this year, but it had 2016 and 2015. I don't think it'll necessarily get a Booker Prize with my book. But my book is, if you like, a lighthearted take on where we now are in political terms in the whole Brexit Trump environment. And it's a book called Compromat, K-O-M-P-R-O-M-A-T, Compromat. Our publication day, September the 28th, 2017. And see you all there.
Very good. We shall let you get on and write it. Thanks very much, Stanley.
So that is just about it for Sustainababble 75. What an interesting chat. I hope you found it as enthralling as I did. And I would like to say that I never thought I would be able to say I spent the morning teaching the Foreign Secretary's father how to use Skype. And now I can say that, and I'm very pleased with myself.
Very good, Al. Splendid all round, and wasn't it for the benefit of the babble? You can get in touch with us. Tell us what you thought of the show. Tell us what you thought of Stanley. We are on Facebook. Just search Sustainababble. You can find us on Twitter at The Babble Wagon, or drop us an email to hello@sustainababble.fish. And if you like what you heard, and if you like our other stuff, check out our other episodes, and do please, please, please give us a little review. 5 stars would be nice, but, you know, whatevs.
Yeah, thank you as ever to you, Dave, for babbling magnificently, but also thank you to the wonderful Dickie Moore, who provides the music that is the beginning, the end, and the intertwingly bit of this podcast. We'll be back next week, as Dave said. Until then, Brexit hard. Trigger all the articles you can.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Wonderful, you've got the technology like it is. Well, I'm now going to click on this red button which says end call.